Welcome to Off Script with Dan Dwyer on Robin Hood Radio, featuring in-depth interviews with guests from the world of theater and allied arts. Underwriting support from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare collectible and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th-century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. And now, here's the host of Off Script, Dan Dwyer.
Before there was the Me Too movement, and before the scandals rocked the Catholic Church, there was an actor based in New York with a deeply personal secret about a sexual relationship he had with an older man when he was between the ages of 12 and 15. The actor is Martin Moran, and out of his experience came the play in 2005, a one-man autobiographical play and book called The Tricky Part. The play won the Obie and was nominated for an Outer Critics Circle and Drama Desk Award, and the book won the Lambda Literary Award. Martin revived the show off-Broadway last year, and he will do just three performances of it the weekend of July 12 through 14 at the Ankrum Opera House. I'm joining him today at the Opera House to talk about The Tricky Part. Welcome, Martin, to Off Script.
Thank you, Dan.
And thank you for having me at the Ankrum Opera House.
A pleasure.
Hello. So, before we start talking about The Tricky Part, let me just put up front what we have in common. Martin Moran and Dan Dwyer, full name Daniel Francis Dwyer.
Oh, Lord.
I think that qualifies as Irish-American.
Yes.
We have that in common.
You've got two saints going on there, at least.
Thank you very much. I need them. We're both gay.
Okay. Yes.
We both have a Roman Catholic background. Hmm. And we both sort of, I'm a little older than you, but I grew up in the late 50s, you grew up in the 60s. So we have all that in common.
Yeah,
right?
It's okay. A lot.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's important because, well, we'll get into it, but Roman Catholic has got to be part of the story.
Tremendously so. In fact, the first part of the play is very much about laying in the context of that Catholic world, because I think, you know, in any community, that part of any story is the community within which the story takes place. And certainly a story that involves sexual trespass, as I've called it in the past, would be one thing in, say, New Guinea, but another thing when you're in a Republican family in the middle of America in a very, very strict Catholic upbringing. It adds a certain, you've absorbed a certain kind of gravity or the notion of it's not just something criminal happening or secret. It's actually, I'm doing something evil, or those things that come up in a Catholic context.
You've already given us a lot to unpack.
Yeah, that's
There's a lot of trigger words in your introduction. But for people who are completely unfamiliar with the play or the book, could you just set the stage for what you do? For what? Is it 85 minutes?
Yeah, it's about 85 minutes. And it's me telling a story about growing up Catholic in the middle of America in Denver, Colorado. Beautiful place to grow up. And tumbling into, at a very young age, at 12 years old, a sexual entanglement, relationship. You know, relationship's a very loaded word as well. But with an older man who was a counselor at a Catholic boys camp, who was well over, nearly 20 years my senior. And so, in some ways, this story that we've all become familiar with and that is pushes a lot of buttons in it, because it's tabloid, it's scary, it's one of those, it's those story that's been in the news a lot. What I do in this 85 minutes is try to look at that matter-of-factly with complexity, even humor, and try to tell the truth about the experience. And it's bookended with what happened when I was 12 and also finding the man when the man who was my perpetrator, we use that word, the man with whom I had the relationship. I sought him out when he was in his 60s. I was in my early 40s. And part of the play is the sort of adventure and the reality and the complexity of talking to him.
So how old were you when you started to write the play?
Somewhere in my late 30s, mm-hmm. I began to be a little more aware that this imperative was going on inside of me. Mm-hmm. You know, it was scribbles, secret scribbles in journals. It was a little scribble on the side of the page. Tell the truth about what happened when you were 12. And I was like, what? What? I began scribbling very secretively. But being an actor and a storyteller, somehow the kind of quiet, secret journal writing slowly grew into a full-blown off-Broadway play.
So you tell the story, you told the story a lot in 2005 on stage, right?
Yes.
You got the Obie Award for that and Drama Critics and Outer Critics Circle nominations. And out of that also came the book. But when did the story first come out of your mouth?
Mm.
When did you get it off the scribblings on the side of your journal and actually tell your story to someone else?
You know, it's a really good question, Dan, because there's a way in which I think anyone who's been through a similar kind of experience can probably relate to this. There's a way in which the story was so packed away inside of me in some deep compartment that there was a way in which snippets of it sort of it would pop out. I remember being doing a show in Philadelphia years ago in my mid-30s. So, but it's definitely nothing is really coming out in any real way until my early 30s, mid-30s. But offhandedly, for instance, working on a song with a composer, I was in a musical, and the subject sort of came up about being young and having sex, and I made a joke. I said, oh, yeah, I was one of those Catholic boys who was diddled when I was, you know, or some, and he turned to me. This is a wonderful composer named Ricky Gordon. I don't know if you know. And he looked at me with these eyes, and he said, you know, that's a big deal. And I was like, no, it wasn't a big deal. But it's like a little lid opens and something sneaks out that, you know, the proverbial can of worms. Or something. Mm-hmm. And this feeling keeps growing of there is a way in which my past, I have not looked at a profoundly gripping and complex part of my early life. And I think anyone who's, you know, if you're in therapy or, but in my case, being a storyteller, being an actor, what happened was it began to leak out and form as a piece of art, I guess you could say. And my mother and my father and my family, all of them encountered the full breadth of the story at the same time that the public did in a certain way. I mean, I began to speak to them about it as the, you know, I thought, oh my God, I'm going to be doing a play. I better really lay it out. And so it took me a long time. And we're talking late 30s into, when the play opened off Broadway, I was 44 years old by then.
In case you're just joining us, the program is off script, and my guest is Martin Moran. He's talking about his play, The Tricky Part, which he's going to perform in three performances, July 12th through 14th at the Ancrum Opera House. So this relationship ended around the age of 15,
yes.
I gather. And now you've talked about how snippets of your experience would sort of sneak out in your 30s. So that's 15, 16, 17 years of carrying a lot of baggage around. What kind of effect did that have on yourself, on your career, on your relationships with other men or just people in general?
Well, it had a huge effect. And in retrospect, I'm able to see many more of the elements of that. Initially, just right off the bat, one of the things I can think of is sorting out my own genuine sexuality was one thing, because there's a way in which I think when things happen to you when you're young, before your brain is ready, you have a traumatizing, it's so huge, it's traumatizing, the wires kind of get all, you know, your nerve endings, so initially it was, I found it really difficult to have a sense of, who am I? Am I gay? Am I homosexual? Or did he do that to me? You know, that mm-hmm. classic thing. It took me a long time to sort that out. Somewhere in college, there was a day when, you know, I thought, okay, boom, I'm gay. I'm attracted to men. I've got to face up to this. I came from a very conservative Republican Catholic family. And so coming to that was difficult in and of itself. As time went on, it somehow was also, realizing I was gay was also sort of having the courage to leave Stanford University, where I was Mr. Conservative, studying pre-law, going to be a senator and a Catholic dad with six kids. Mm-hmm. It was like, I'm dead, and I'm going to go to acting school. And at the same time, my desire to be an artist and my sexuality sort of were intertwined. Mm-hmm. And I left Stanford my second year and found my way to ACT in San Francisco and began here and there having encounters with men, relationships with men, and I had found a kind of a boyfriend, and it was slow going. But the other thing I would say, the other major thing, is that as my 20s unfolded and I got into my 20s and early 30s, I definitely dealt with a huge wave of what, for lack of a better description, saying, sexual addiction, like just a compulsivity that was part of unpacking the past, because it was a way of, I think it was just part of the trauma. Mm-hmm. And part of that, it's, in a very complex way, is seeking out addictive, unconscious, compulsive sex. And, hello, listeners, I know this is really out there, but it's part of, it was part of the legacy of the complexity of what happened. And so it took a lot of work and sorting out, but I have a husband, and we've been together for 34 years, and he has stood by me and walked along, Henry Stram, a wonderful actor, and he's, walked with me through all of these discoveries and ups and downs and dramas.
One of the terms that you haven't used to describe your experience is abuse. Mm. You've used the term in this conversation so far and in the materials I did read before coming here today, the term sexual trespass. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the difference?
Ultimately in some reality, there is no difference. There, it is an adult's, it's a kid's job to fall in love. It's an adult job to have boundaries, period. So what happened to me was abuse. As an artist, as a writer, as a man making a piece of theater, I think the best way I can describe it is that I didn't want to have a certain sense of shutdown of abuse. Who'd want to hear about that, or who'd want to come to that show? Or, even that it is a show is so still full of mystery to me, that it actually happened. For 85 minutes, I walked through this territory. But essentially what I want to try to say is that Mike Nichols always used to say, a story is about something, but it's really about something else. In this case, you might say, as you did so eloquently in your introduction, try to sort of encapsulate. Here's a narrative of a guy who had a sexual experience as a young kid, and he's written a show about it. But really, what the tricky part is, hence the title, hence everything else, and it still is for me, it's a journey through complexity. Yes, there was abuse, there was trespass, there was violation. I think part of what I'm asking and inviting folks into is a territory of paradox, a territory of complexity. And I think that I probably use the word trespass to give a kind of, for whatever reason, I find the word less negative, less tabloidy. Mm-hmm. And what the tricky part is as radical as it may sound, it's like, come in and look at this, and not as a tabloid story, not as a black and white, but the place that art, hopefully in its best ways, and I say this with all humility because I still strive for it, I know, but a place where theater and art and being together in a room, walking through a story together that is filled with mystery, complexity, ultimately is filled with the unknowable about existence. And the place we confront those unknowables, I think, are in the places where we are confronted with violence and forgiveness, with pain, with joy, with discovery, with God, with mystery. all of those things were part of my sexual awakening. Blake used to say, well, it's not so much a journey from innocence to guilt or innocence to not innocence. It's everything's a journey from maybe innocence to knowledge.
I don't want to simplify this.
Yeah.
But when you talk about your journey and the knowledge of it and the natural prospect of any teenager having a sexual awakening, do you think it was just, I don't want to say bad luck, or do you just think it happened with someone who just happened not to be age appropriate?
In a way, yes. It happened with someone who was not age appropriate, and also happened with someone who was deeply unconscious and unwell.
Oh.
You know, and one really comes to know that when you're then that person's age and you face a 12-year-old and you think, oh, look, could I ever cross that line? No. Now, age is tricky, right? You get to 16, 17, you get to 8, you get to a curious young gay person. Hey, people have had all sorts of awakening experiences and they may have been beautiful. Or they may, in this Catholic context, at an age of 12, before the brain, prepubescent, there was a violence, a trauma to it. There's no question. At the same time, yes, it was life. It was awakening. It was energy. I was going toward life. It wasn't in... Yeah, go ahead, Dan. Yeah.
No. I'm just...
Yeah, I know. I can see you're engaged, and I love your questions.
The words that come to mind, because, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, in ways... which doesn't compare to any of the trauma that you've experienced, but being Irish and Catholic,
yeah,
and being sexually active at a young age myself, shame, guilt.
Mm, huge.
How did you accommodate that for the 15 years before you started working on this?
Well, accommodate is really an interesting word. There's a way in which shame is... You know, I read about often. Read what's the difference between guilt and shame, and you know, guilt may be tied to an act, shame like a way of a sort of abiding sense of being. I'm full of shame. I don't know if I accommodated it somehow, obviously, because I'm still alive. But you know, there was a long chunk of time there where I was, you know, I was suicidal. I was profoundly depressed and in profound, terrifying pain. And it took a long time to identify it and unpack it. You know, our bodies are so, our temple, our guide, our wisdom. And to that, as you mentioned, that Irish Catholic upbringing, part of a layer of the violence, I think, is that somewhere in that culture is a profound sense of shame about the body. It's an essential sense. Spirit good, body bad. We are basically here to earn our way toward the bodiless eternity, somewhere in a nice place with God and all the saints. But the reality of being in a body and thinking that it's not good or that it's something full of shame is a terrible kind of start in life. And we are, as Irish Catholics, imbued with that.
In case you're joining us, we're going to come up on the last leg of this interview with Martin Moran. He is the author of the book and the performer of the play, his autobiographical, The Tricky Part, which can be seen at the Ankrum Opera House July 12th through July 14th in three performances. I mentioned in the introduction that you were ahead of the game by telling your story, because we've seen Me Too happen since, and we've seen all the details around the world about the Roman Catholic Church. You had the play back in New York in 2018, last year, I guess.
We did a revival last November.
So is the, I mean, I don't want to sound trite, but is the play more relevant now? Is it more relevant to more people now?
You know, it's a good question. You know, it's so much more in our discourse, of course, the Me Too. You know, this happening, you know, the sense of the secrecy arising and people coming forward. You know, it's hard for me to say if it's... there's certainly a different temperature in the air culturally. I actually thought about, oh, I'm going to need to tweak the play or change it. It's been 15 years. And Seth Barish, my wonderful director, and I went through the script and we realized, no, we're not going to change a word. It's the same play 15 years ago as it is today. Again, because it's dealing with the mystery and the complexity of this human experience of awake sexuality, of the notion of trauma, human relationship. And, you know, I had a better answer for that. I find that what's mainly different is that now I'm nearly 60 and have gray hair, and there's a profound way that I experience the play. I own the play much less than I did 15 years ago. There's a way in which the questions circling at the center of it are what excite me and give me joy, and that the story, I don't own it. It's not my story so much anymore. It's a story that was crafted and is true, but it has an energy, a sort of Shakti of its own. Mm-hmm. And that's liberating.
It's not your story anymore, but the story is more prevalent than we think.
Yes.
I grew up in an Irish Catholic household in the parish that I went to. I wasn't aware of any kind of abuse that was going on. But later in life, let's just say I had the occasion to hear a lot of stories from a lot of men who were suffering from some kind of drug or alcohol addiction.
Yes, yes.
And I was stunned at the incidence of sexual abuse at an early age with people who have addictions later in life.
Yeah.
Does that make sense to you?
Completely.
Yeah.
Because part of the package of what is so painful and damaging and violent is that I think it's just unavoidable. It's just part of the experience that a child, a young person, feels utterly, not just complicit, but at fault. Mm. What did I do to welcome this? Why wasn't I man enough to stop it? I should have I should have hit the guy. There's a way in which all of those notions of shame wrap around the core of you in a soup of self-loathing. And self-loathing leads to addiction. Yeah. It just does. You want to get out of your feelings.
We could go on with this conversation for a long time. I think we've got time for one more question. And to bring it, I think, probably to a practical level. Youthful sexuality, or let's say sexual trespass or sexual abuse for people who are confronted with that, is something that exists secretly. But if you're a parent, if you're a relative, and you suspect there's a young person, a young woman or a young man or a boy or a girl who's in some kind of jeopardy, what should people do?
Wow. You know, it's...
Because no one really wants to deal with it if they think it's happening, but they can't prove it.
Yeah. You know, Dan, it's a very important and incisive question. I feel like those who work in professionally in health, healthcare and law probably are much more versed in an expertise way. My sense is that to say, as a young person who had that experience, to parents, say, is that the profoundly important thing for parents, I think, is to, obviously, is this to be in communication with your kids, to be open to be connected. I was very, very disconnected from my parents, and I think that's part of what led to what happened. But if it's, I'm not sure, I'm sure there's somewhere that says these are the good steps to take. But I would say that speaking, it's just whatever that impulse is, to feel that it's insurmountable to speak about it, try to find the person that would be the most appropriate and the most professional to speak about it and speak. Okay. And speak, because it feels overwhelming. And, here I am as someone who went from totally overwhelming to making a play about it it still fascinates me that happened in my life, and that there's this play that is enjoyed and talked about, and that people are still asking me to do. And it's a tremendous pleasure to come to this beautiful part of the world and offer it.
Thank you, Martin.
Thank you.
Thank you for the conversation.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Yeah. In case you've been listening, the program's off script. I'm the host, Dan Dwyer. My guest has been Martin Moran, who is the author and the performer of the autobiographical The Tricky Part, which you can see in three performances at the Ankrum Opera House, July 12, 13, and 14. Thanks for joining us.
Underwriting support for Off Script with Dan Dwyer from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare collectible and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. Off Script with Dan Dwyer is also available via podcast on our on-demand page, robinhoodradio.com. Click on On Demand and then click on Off Script with Dan Dwyer.